Welcome to Life Sciences and Science Life, a science podcast of the University of Vienna's Doctoral School of Pharmaceutical, Nutritional and Sports Sciences.
Our team of PhD candidates, along with various experts in the field, talk about current advances in sciences while exploring the challenges and triumphs of PhD life.
To this episode, I am delighted to welcome Assistant Professor Dr. Marietta Zille, a neuroscientist by training, with expertise in pharmacology, with long-standing experience. Welcome, Marietta.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Can you tell us about your research and what are you doing?
Yeah, of course. So I'm a neuroscientist by training, as you said. So I actually did my master's and PhD in neuroscience in Germany, where I studied how cells die after an ischemic stroke. So an ischemic stroke is a stroke where a blood vessel is occluded in the brain. This leads to an interruption of the blood flow, so the cells can no longer be nourished. And this has devastating consequences for patients with stroke. So it means that they can't talk, they cannot move their arms. And this is very bad, obviously. So we were interested to see how cells die and how we can maybe, you know, make interventions that can rescue these cells. And then for the postdoc, I went to the US, where I also studied cell death mechanisms, but more in the context of hemorrhagic stroke. So in hemorrhagic stroke, there is a blood vessel that ruptures inside the brain, so that blood spills into the brain, and the mechanisms, interestingly, are very different. Now, you know, coming from this valley of death, I decided that for my work as a PI here, I would like to focus more on also the etiology. So how actually strokes arise, what are the risks, and what are the mechanisms, how they evolve, and not only strokes, but also other diseases that affect the brain. And we are also interested in how the brain ages. And ultimately, we want to discover new interventions, be it drugs or other treatments, that may help the patients and address these, you know, the risk factors, but also the pathophysiological consequences. So something like cell death, etc.
Thank you, Marietta. That was very interesting. So you have a very long-standing research career, and often there are situations where things don't go your way. And sometimes we refer to them as null results. In your words, could you explain us what is these null results?
Yes, so I like that you actually use null results, because a lot of people refer to them as negative results, which I don't like, because it's a wrong connotation in my opinion. So a null result is when actually you cannot find differences between two groups. So this is your alternative hypothesis that you usually, you don't want to reject. And then if you reject it, then the null hypothesis would be true. So, you know, if you can't find differences between two groups, then usually people will be like, okay, this is not a good result, this is a bad result, negative result, and they will probably discard it. And in my opinion, this causes a lot of problems. So, every result is a result. So my postdoctoral supervisor said, the data are what the data are. And if you look at it this way, then maybe you don't look at this as a negative thing or something that will impact your life so much, you know, but it's just part of discovery, because not everything that you can, or every hypothesis that you can come up with, every model is obviously right, you know, because we don't know what is happening in a cell, in a body, in a cell, you know, how molecules behave. We can only make model and predictions and then test it using a set of experiments. So, and whatever we find with these experiments, in my opinion, is a valid result.
I still have some questions on this. So you say it's testing the hypothesis, and sometimes the hypothesis is not what you expected, and it's an alternative one. And for a PhD student, do you think it's actually advancing the scientific research, or how should one approach these results and how to see them? Is it advancing or it's stopping?
Okay, advancing or stopping? Yeah, this is a difficult question. I mean, the question I think first is you have to understand what is the reason for a null result. So there could be many reasons. One reason could be that your technique is just not picking up anything, so you are not finding the differences between two groups. So actually, what you must understand first is whether the technique, the method you are using, is actually good enough, has like a certain range, you know, could be of the assay that is actually able to detect differences. So let's say if there is a technical mistake, or let's say a technique that cannot, or method that cannot detect the differences, then you might just find a null result, which is a false null result, you know. So what you need to find out first is whether the method that you're using, you are using it in a correct way first, so that it actually works. Of course, these kind of problems or mistakes can occur as well. So you just have to go through your notes, the protocol, if everything worked. For this, there is an, I would not say easy solution, but there is a solution. You can just use a positive control. So if you run an experiment, you should always include a positive control that you know that your method is working. And if you find that it is working with a positive control, but then you don't see a change in your experimental, in your test, you know, then you at least can rule out that it's because of the technical mistake. You know, so making a technical mistake, of course, this you can try to avoid. But if there's really no differences between two treatments groups, for example, yeah, if there's a really no difference, I think it is very important to publish and to, discuss those results, because maybe, I mean, the data is telling you something, right? So maybe it's in a different direction that you have to look and continue your discovery. If you just discard the negative result or the null result or whatever, then you will, you may actually overlook something and you may go in the wrong direction. Of course, science advances, so we have only the knowledge that we have now, and we have only the techniques that we have now. And with new techniques, we may be able to see more, to understand better. You know, just think about microscopes. Before we had microscopes, we were not able to see on the cellular level, you know, what happens in the cell. So we only had organs, and then if there is, you know, a huge tumor or something, then maybe, okay, there is a huge lesion that could explain something. But now we can dive deeper, we can see the cellular level. And now, of course, microscopes, you know, who talks about microscopes? Now we have single cell sequencing and all this. So we can go at subcellular level, at submolecular level, at, you know, the finest level. And of course, what we find now may, you know, outdate or is more advanced than what we found like 5 years ago. But it doesn't mean that what we did 5 years ago was necessarily wrong. It's just that using the techniques, models, and methods that we had, we found, you know, whatever, this difference or no difference. And maybe if we just use a more, if, you know, if there is not a good method to detect that there are differences between two groups, then maybe you just need a different method for it as well, you know?
So in addition to this, when you know that your experiment is working perfect and you are getting some negative results for quite some times, do you have any idea that when to stop to try? Can you please have a word on this?
Yes, this is a second, or I mean, there is a second reason why we can have null results, right? And that is the sample size. So if I have, so the sample size is the amount of, you know, replicates that I'm running for each group. And the number needed to find a difference between groups depends on the effect size. So how much of a difference is there between two groups and how big is the variability in each group. So if I have a large effect, Yeah, but a small variability, I don't need that many replicates. But if I have a method that is not very precise and detects and, you know, creates a huge technical variability, then with a small effect, I may, you know, end up having statistically no significant difference. So what you actually need to do is you need to run a pilot experiment to understand what is your mean difference between the two groups and also what is your variability. And I mean, ideally, the technical variability is low and you only are concerned with the biological variability, you know. And so if you understand your mean difference and the variability in the groups, then you can use what is called a priori sample size calculation. And then this will, you know, statistically calculate how many replicates you need. And then what you should do is you should run this experiment again with the correct number of replicates. And then if you find no difference, then it's more likely to be a true null result, let's say. Still, of course, it's not 100% sure. And then, of course, include a positive control. And for each positive, if you have a positive result, let's say, you should also include negative controls, of course. So when should you stop? Yeah, it depends, you know. But if you design the experiment in a way that you can, you know, if you have a priori defined your sample size, you should run the study in this way and then just do it all at best. If you're using patients or animals or something, then you do it in a blinded way at best. And then only after you have collected all the data, then you make your analysis. And you're not trying to fish for an effect, just adding another N and another N, you know. But this is, yeah, there's a difference between an exploratory study and a real, you know, a study that really looks for differences. And in my opinion, most papers that are published are unfortunately, you know, rather exploratory. So they are actually publishing this initial experiment where we are, you know, running a few replicates on, you know, our whatever idea we have, and then we are publishing it. And this is definitely, I mean, that's not the only reason, but one of the reasons, the sample size is one of the reasons why we have many non-reproducible findings that are published in the literature.
Thank you so much, Marietta. Very interesting answers from you. I would like to ask you your personal experience. When was the first time you had null results and how did you deal with this?
Yeah, I don't know if it was the first time, but the one time that, of course, is in my memory the strongest is as part of my PhD, I performed experiments where it just simply didn't work. So maybe to start from the beginning. So as I told you, we were interested in assessing cell death after stroke, and we had a probe that we used to assess this in an animal, and this was, you know, tagged with a near infrared dye, so we could actually look at this in the living animal to see whether there are cells dying in a certain, you know, using a certain mechanism of cell death. And the thing was that we wanted to look at this phenomenon over time in the same animal. And for this, we actually developed this probe into a probe that could be used using a single photon emission computed tomography. So this is a device that can measure a radioactive signal that is emitted from this probe. So if you are using the probe, then once it goes to a cell or binds to a cell that dies, then you would see an accumulation of the signal in these animals. And the idea was that with this SPECT imaging, we can attach different radioactive isotopes and then look at the same thing over time, like the same probe over time in the same animal, which would be super interesting, right? Yeah, and it turned out that it worked beautifully, you know, in the near infrared, but it didn't. I couldn't get it to work with the radioactive signal. And I was like, yeah, so what should I do with this? You know, now it's crazy. My whole PhD, you know, I wanted to work with this. And so, yeah, I was actually lucky that I was trained in a department, or yeah, I had a mentor, my mentor and PhD supervisor, who, this is Ulrich Dirnagel. I discussed with him, so what should I do? Because we know the probe is working, but it's just not working when we are attaching this radioactive isotope. And so, yeah, as I told you before, we just thought, okay, let's make a positive control. That, you know, to show that the probe is actually working. But my hypothesis at the time was that it's just not crossing the blood-brain barrier anymore. And so that's what I actually ended up doing, to use the same probe in a positive control animal. And it turned out that, you know, it actually still detected the cell death, but it just never could not cross for some reason anymore the blood-brain barrier. So, you know, and then basically I just, you know, decided, okay, how many animals I would need to show that technically it's feasible and that we are still seeing, of course, this signal and so on and so forth. And, yeah, he encouraged me to do this. And so then I wrote up the manuscript and we submitted it, and it was not published in a bad journal. It was actually in quite a good journal for the field. And so this was actually, you know, the main paper of my PhD thesis. And you would consider it a negative result or null result paper, right? So I think it's possible to publish also null results, you know, if you're doing the right controls with it. And of course, it was not the only paper of my PhD, you know, so I have had multiple papers, but this was really the main paper. And, you know, not only you can publish the null results, but I must say that, you know, I was actually lucky. I also got an award by the Charité, where I did my PhD, for the best thesis of, you know, 2 years, like within 2 years that they were assessing. So even, let's say, using as a main paper of the PhD, a negative results paper or a null results paper, you know, still got me an award. So I think, you know, you don't have to discard this and put these ideas in the drawer and not publish it. Because actually, I think that, so I was looking at the literature that was assessing exactly this kind of, way to make like these probes, and at some point the literature stopped, and only later kind of I can never verify this hypothesis whether this is true, but I think that the researchers already encountered a problem and then they stopped publishing on it to say that, well, this doesn't work. And so I didn't know it doesn't work. So I followed up on this very, you know, like laborious task, and to make all these steps to make the probe. But if they had published it, maybe we would not have had designed it in this way, or we would have come up with something completely different for my PhD, right? So I think, you know, publishing the null results can have an impact on a PhD career, can have also an impact, of course, much on, you know, the whole field, right? Because we are not biasing our publications in one direction. It would be better to have a more, you know, well-rounded, unbiased landscape of publications where, you know, people publishing also the things that they are, there is no difference. And then this will benefit, you know, also society, patients, you know, publishing studies where maybe the drug had no effect, you know, that's equally important, because then you can do, you can run a meta-analysis or, you know, systematic review meta-analysis and find the actual true effect size, rather than, you know, just basing it on a publication bias system where we are only looking at the sort of positive results.
Okay. So I have several questions from the story that you shared. Like, how did you communicate your null result to your supervisor? Because this is not the easy step, you know, when you're going through the research and when you have a negative or something that you don't expect, how was it to communicate to your supervisor?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was quite lucky because he is so much open to this. Actually, I mean, if you follow him, what he's doing now, he has completely switched from, you know, doing basic research into this whole field of, you know, improving science quality. And they have, you know, their own center, they have a quest center. So they are, you know, they are really into the education of scientists, into, you know, promoting people to publish null results. So I think I was at a very lucky situation in this, at this time, that, you know, he was not screaming at me or something, you know, why you found this. But yeah, I mean, I think if for my own lab, I have the same philosophy. I just tell people, okay, the data are what the data are. I mean, you need to know the limitation of your method, and you need to know whether you did everything correctly. So first, if there is something that didn't work, you go back to the lab book and check and, you know, see, did we use the positive control? Did the positive control also not work? Then rerun it because, you know, there was a technical mistake. But in the end, if a person doesn't accept that that not all the models and hypotheses that one comes up with are correct, then I think there is a greater problem to that person, right? So I think I didn't quite answer the question yet, right? So you wanted to know how to approach the PI or, you know, your supervisor. So it always depends on the person, obviously. I mean, you need to find a good way to communicate with each other. And, you know, it depends on both people, I guess, how they communicate with each other. In my lab, we have like an open door policy. We have like a policy kind of like everyone can make mistakes and it's not a problem. And I also make mistakes, and kind of by showing to my students or, you know, that I also make mistakes, it makes it, let's say, hopefully more easy for them to also say that they have made a mistake. Right. So there's a difference between making a mistake in like pipetting in a wrong way, then definitely you need to repeat the experiment. But if you're not finding a difference, biological difference between two groups, because there may simply not be one, then this is the result and the data are what the data are. And this needs to be clearly communicated. And talking to your supervisor, as I said, you have to find the good way to communicate, and making sure, of course, that the person also listens to when and not just ignores these null results. If the person still continues to tell you that you should do the experiment and, I don't know, generate something that supports the hypothesis, then, I mean, you can just continue to tell that this is the data, you know, I did it in this way, this is how it was, and document it and, you know, write that, well, you know, I found exactly this under these circumstances. But I guess this goes more into like how to manage a difficult relationship if there is one. But I think, yeah, just frankly discussing your data and openly showing, you know, and of course documenting also how you came up with this data that, you know, shows that you included all the negative positive controls. That is, of course, very important.
So you mentioned that There was a group which failed to publish the null result. Had they published before, it would have not been necessary for you to carry on with that hypothesis. How does a researcher decide whether to publish a null result or to not publish?
Yeah, in my opinion, if you do your research in a good way, you can publish any result that you have. There may be reasons why you don't want to publish the null result. Let's say if you're not sure that it's a real negative or real null result. But again, then it comes to the experimental design, or maybe the methods is not, you know, picking up the differences, then maybe, yeah. But otherwise, nowadays, there are so many ways to publish data. Even, you know, you don't need to make a complete manuscript out of it, but still people would be able to use it. You know, you can publish it in repositories or on preprints. But another reason why you may not want to publish it as a real paper is because publishing papers takes a lot of time, right? And time is limited. So I completely understand that people say, like, well, I don't want to publish this because, yeah, it doesn't support us on our hypothesis. It doesn't help me because maybe I will get less grants if I publish all these results that we have shown no differences, or simply I don't have time because, you know, there's too many other things to do. I can focus my time on publishing the real high impact papers and so on and so forth. So yeah, it's also a little bit of fault of the publishing system, right? That you have to write up so many things to come up with a paper and then put it for the reviewers and so on and so forth. But I believe that if more null results are published, less research money is spent on repeating experiments that just make null results in the end. And in the end, also when it comes to publishing, most of us are using taxpayer money to perform research, right? So the taxpayer should be able to read what you have been doing with the money. So even if you don't find differences, theoretically, if you think about this, then the taxpayer should be able to read that. So you should publish it. You should publish some outcomes from what you are doing.
As a PhD student, you are in your final year, and what you have is you have only the null results of your hypothesis, whatever you are trying. What do you think about this?
I think that doing a PhD doesn't mean you have to get the most, you know, grandiose results with the largest effect size and whatnot. I think the PhD journey is for you to understand how science works, how you can make scientific discovery, understand the limitations of your work, of your methods, of your models. And if you can explain, you know, how you derive the null results and that you technically did all the steps to ensure that what you are showing, that there is no biological difference, basically, is what you are showing, you know, then I think it's completely valid. And, phrasing the limitations or, you know, communicating the limitations of your models and giving maybe some insights on how this can be done in a better way will also be helpful. So I think you can still do a PhD on that. And maybe if you really have only null results, then you should definitely be thinking about publishing some of this, you know, and use this and showcase this also to you know, the wider audience.
Thanks, Marietta. That's a very productive discussion. I would like to ask you a final piece of advice on this whole discussion, what we have.
The data are what the data are. So just don't be afraid to think about your project in different ways, and to don't be afraid to also you know, publish and communicate null results.
That brings us to the end of today's episode on the impact of null results in PhD research. A huge thanks to Dr. Marietta Zille for sharing her insights, experience, and refreshing perspective.
That's it for this episode of Life Sciences and Science Life. We are your hosts, Ranjit and
Hari.
Tune in next month for more intriguing science topics, relatable PhD experiences, and expert contributions on how to navigate a career path of a young scientist.
Our next episode will be about musculoskeletal modeling with Alexander Putzel. This is a podcast of the University of Vienna's Doctoral School of Pharmaceutical, Nutritional, and Sports Sciences. Don't forget to follow us on LinkedIn. Thank you for listening. See you next time. Thank you.